I want to try and bring out today two threads which are consistently there in our pattern, but sometimes seem parallel or disparate rather than integrative. One thread is the personal development, which is contemporaneous, your development now, late 20th century Los Angeles Americans trying to find your way. And the other thread is the so-called occult traditions of antiquity, the hermetic traditions of antiquity, which are said, with quotation marks, to have had revivals in the Renaissance and still operating, quote, today, and so forth. These two threads, how are you putting yourself together, and what does that have to do with an ancient wisdom tradition? So those two threads have to be brought together more sufficiently today so that you can understand that there is not just a correlation, but that there is an organic continuity in these two threads. And I'm using the language organic continuity, I'm using it like Frank Lloyd Wright would have used those terms. And we'll go to Frank Lloyd Wright about halfway through the morning. In order to put us into perspective of how to twine these two together, and you need to have a kind of a cognizance here, a perceptual realization here that these two threads have always been twined together. The two serpents that are intertwined on the hermetic caduceus are these two threads, these two energy sources, which physiologically, incidentally, are indicated in the physical structure in the spinal column, the two columns of energy. It's the same as the figure of the DNA helix. There aren't three, there aren't four, there aren't five, there are not six, there are two spirals that are interrelated. So that you have to have the perceptual realization that this is a universal structure. That if you cut a cross section in all forms of life, you will find that this structure obtains. And thus, in any kind of an educational pattern, which is real, this structure also will obtain, and does obtain. But to be conscious of it, one has to be able to examine in a little bit more detail than we have. And the examination has a fulcrum, a basic single symbolic fulcrum on which the accuracy of your understanding rests. Jerry, you can set up your tape recorder if you want. So I want to bring us back to something which we had looked at several months ago and use this as the key, the starting point, the pitch pipe tone on which to hone our intelligence on the issue of how do the two threads, my personal integration and an ancient wisdom tradition, how do they go together? And just why is it that they go together in an organic continuity? That's the specific question before us. Now for the resolution of that. I'm going to take us back to one of the handouts. Most of you got this, a Xerox of several pages from Chapter 2 of Dame Frances Yates' The Art of Memory. In Chapter 2, The Art of Memory in Greece, Memory and the Soul. And at the core of her chapter, she gives a quotation from Plato, from the dialogue of Plato called the Phaedrus, one of Plato's great dialogues that he wrote in midstream of his life and has a tremendous power to it, the power of comprehension. In the Phaedrus, Socrates tells the following story, and here's the quotation, and this is from the Loeb edition of Plato. Loeb classics are published by Harvard. There are about 600 volumes in the Loeb Library of Translations. Plato. "I heard then," says Socrates, "that at Naucratis in Egypt was one of the ancient gods of that country, the one whose sacred bird is called the ibis, and the name of the god himself was Thoth." Now, I give you emendation as we go along so you can position it intellectually. Naucratis is in the Egyptian delta, rather over towards the Canoptic branch of the Nile, about 100 miles from Alexandria, and about an equal distance or so from Cairo. Naucratis was the only place in Egypt that was officially allowed as a trading port for the Greeks. The Greeks had a reputation which resulted in the phrase in antiquity, "Beware of Greeks bearing gifts." So it was like the Chinese Empire that allowed the British to have a port at Hong Kong, and that's it. Well, the Egyptians allowed the Greeks to have one port at Naucratis. And the peculiar irony is that Naucratis was one of the most esoteric ancient centers. But at the time in Egypt when the Greeks were allowed Naucratis, those Egyptians did not remember the esoteric meaning of Naucratis, because for them, they were interested in the kind of power plays that centered around a Memphite or a Theban theology, and ancient Delta archaeological sites were not of interest to them. So one of the great accidents of history, or one of the great synchronicities of the evolvement of the spirit on the planet, was that the Greeks were allowed one port in Egypt, and that was Naucratis, in the the West Delta. You know, the Delta of Egypt opens up at an angle of 36 degrees. It's the angle of the open hand. The Los Angeles Basin is exactly the same angle. Exactly the same. So, in Plato's dialogue, The Phaedrus, Plato has Socrates telling the story about the Greeks at Naucratis. And Socrates says, "I heard then that at Naucratis in Egypt was one of the ancient gods of that country, the one whose sacred bird is called the ibis, and the name of the god himself was Thoth. He it was who invented numbers and arithmetic and geometry and astronomy." Now I have to pause here. Your minds are not symbolic yet this morning. You're still thinking in a conventional way, a naive way, and nobody heard that. You have to think symbolically now. Plato is very conscious. Thoth it was who invented numbers and arithmetic and geometry and astronomy. How many things are there that he invented? Four. These particular things, in fact, form a square, a very Pythagorean solid square, which later passed on into classical education as the quadrivium, the four subjects that were always taught together, which was the basis of developing the mind. So that the foundation of the mind was this square. Only Plato in deference to Pythagorean tradition, took one of the four and changed it just a little bit. He used a symbolic, esoteric expression of it rather than its formal, educative expression. So the naive would be not so much misled, but not given the whole cake. The quadrivium is indeed astronomy and geometry and arithmetic, but instead of numbers, it's music. Had Plato have just written that out, any learned person in antiquity would have recognized this as a Pythagorean structure. What Socrates is saying is that the Pythagorean structure of the mind is in the Hermetic tradition from Egypt. That's what he's saying. I want to make it clear to you so that we're trying to make this very clear this morning. There's no need to be lax on this. He also invented draughts and dice, and most important of all, letters. Now, draughts and dice have to do with what? With chance. With putting order onto randomness. Because chance is just chance, but if you know probability theory, it's not chance. One can make a different assessment. And most important of all, letters. Now, the king of all Egypt at that time was the god Thammuz. In other words, the Egyptian pharaoh, his colloquial name was Thammuz, and the pharaoh was always considered himself a god. So Socrates is not being naive here. He's just reporting this in kind. So the king of all Egypt at that time was the god Thammuz, who lived in a great city of the upper region, which the Greeks call the Egyptian Thebes. Now notice that you're acquainted right away with the fact that there's a Thebes in Greece as well as a Thebes in Egypt, and indeed they're related. And indeed, the Thebes in Greece is related to the Thebes in Egypt. And about what time in history would the Thebes in Egypt and Greece have had a relationship? About 1600 BC, which was a culmination of an international age. And do you remember who was the founder of Thebes in Greece? Do you remember the story about all the young maidens and the young men that had to be sent to the labyrinth, the Minotaur? And one was able to go in and slay the Minotaur and come back? This was about... That's right. This is related. This is all in that time period. Okay. The pharaoh lived at that time in Thebes, in a great city of the upper region, which the Greeks call the Egyptian Thebes. And they called the god himself Amun, which would be, incidentally, as we would understand it today, Amun-Ra. Amun was just... was enough in Plato's day. We today would call him Amun-Ra. So the invention of letters as an alphabet underwent a sea change around 1600 BC. In other words, there were some letters beforehand, but mostly the kind of inscriptive language there was like cuneiform, which isn't really like letters. And the original letters, we now today in a scholarly way designate that, the original letters, as linear A. You've all heard, I think, of linear B. You're all educated enough to have heard of linear B and how surprised everyone was that linear B, when translated, was actually, when you spoke it, it was Greek, ancient, archaic Greek. There's an earlier form of linear B called linear A. And well, linear B comes from about 1400 BC, linear A comes from about 1700 BC. It's the first time that an alphabet symbolization of consciousness became effective. In other words, that the mind could structure itself on this form and self-consciousness could function in this form. So there's a revolution in language in the sense that written language now becomes extraordinarily powerful. Nevertheless, the story that Socrates is being made to tell in Plato's Phaedrus is about an arcane quality that came into existence at this time with written language. And here's the rest of the story so you can follow it. It's important to us because this is the core of the one thread that we're trying to unite with the other thread. The one thread we're trying to unite it with is our own development. What do we today in May 1989 have to do with ancient wisdom traditions? And why is it that our self-development has an integral, organic continuity with ancient wisdom traditions? Why is this so? And this is the core of why this is so. Is indispensable, as a matter of fact. So Thomas lived in Thebes, and at this time, to him came Thoth to show his invention, saying that they ought to be imparted to the other Egyptians. But Thomas asked what use there was in each, and as Thoth enumerated their uses, expressed praise or blame of the various arts, which it would take too long to repeat. But when they came to letters, "This invention, O king," said Thoth, "will make the Egyptians wiser and will improve their memories, for it is an elixir of memory and wisdom that I have discovered." What is the elixir of memory and wisdom? Written language in a form commensurate with a new scale of relationality in the mind. Why? There's only so much that the mind can develop with cuneiform and those levels of script. But when you have a letter language, the capabilities are phenomenal. The invention of languages, written languages based on letters, was a revolution just like computers are in our own generation. It changed the way everything was done. It changed the process completely. But Thomas replied, "O most ingenious Thoth, one man has the ability to beget arts, but the ability to judge of their usefulness or harmfulness to their users belongs to another. And now you, who are the father of letters, have been led by your affection." Why? Your affection for your children. You've invented letters and they're like children to you. "But you've been led by your affection to ascribe to them a power the opposite of that which they really possess." What you've done, instead of giving a gift to man, you've produced a curse. "For this invention will produce forgetfulness in the minds of those who learn to use it, because they will not practice their memory. Their trust in writing, produced by external characters, which are not part of themselves, will discourage the use of their own memory within them. You have invented an elixir not of memory, but of reminding, and you offer your pupils the appearance of wisdom, not true wisdom. For they will read many things without instruction, and will therefore seem to know many things, when they are for the most part ignorant and hard to get along with, since they are not wise, but only appear wise." Cantankerousness, as every one of you know, grows and sense of false arrogance. Look what a core this is. This is grabbing the problem by the scruff of the neck. But Thomas, though his assessment from the standpoint of a very worldly king, even second-rate pharaohs were usually pretty wise in how to keep the system working. You have to give it to them. They kept things going for 3,000 years. But he wasn't really as wise as Thoth and didn't really understand the new quality of the mind. The old humanity would indeed misuse the new technique. But Thomas did not understand that there could be the possibility of a new humanity who, in using the technique in a new way, would reverse the curse to the blessing that Thoth intended, that Thoth's vision saw, that the creative vision of making a written alphabet language, the creative vision saw indeed the true picture. But the true picture, the true amplification of the symbolic capacity in people has to be actually done. It has to be worked at. It can't be taken for granted. It's just like the new form of the mind that we have now available to us coming up in the 21st century. The old humanity will misuse the techniques, the new techniques of the mind, and produce curses. They have already. Since most of us have been born, the world has steadily degenerated, and peace is going to come from exhaustion and quandary and not from any kind of positive action. But look here, we're not just talking about correlations, we're talking about an organic continuity. What is the new person, 1600 BC? The new person is someone who has formed himself on this written alphabet language. And his expressions, if coming from himself in a new way, what he writes is not the appearance of wisdom, but in fact is his wisdom. But the onus is on, did you actually form yourself this way? Is your interior self actually the focus of these new techniques? If you've used an old educational form with an old self and appropriated this new technique simply as a tool, man as a tool maker is a killer. But man who is a technologist, who understands the use of the tool and commensurate with how it was put together, is a builder. It doesn't mean there are two different kinds of humanities. There aren't two different kinds of people. There aren't the users and the used. It means that with a powerful new technique of forming the mind, we must then reform ourselves. Otherwise, the use of the new technique will certainly be a curse instead of the blessing which poignant vision assures us that is possible. Now, the alphabet written language that we have today is very high-powered mathematics. We have a mathematical capacity by this last decade of the 20th century which is radical in its ability to reform the mind of man. And the fact that the percentage of people who are able to be conversant with just the beginnings, the ABCs of that kind of mind is probably less than 10%, I would think. But the important thing to understand here, let me read this section again, is how the person-making process is directly related, is an organic continuity with the mind formation education. The way in which you learn to think predisposes the way in which you will self-consciously understand yourself and use those capacities. So where is the importance? The fundamental importance is in the educational realm. Whereas its final achievement is in the art of being yourself. So that there is this whole movement towards maturation, which is highlighted by this quote. Now let me read this to you once more and try and pick up. And for those who've come late, you can get the tapes and follow through. We're trying to understand how two threads wind together like the double helix of DNA, like the two serpents on the hermetic caduceus staff, like the two neurophysiological currents in the spinal column. The same principle holds in an educational process, which is real. How do you know it's real? Because it works. That's how you know it's real. The fulcrum is, in this quotation that Frances Yates in her book, The Art of Memory, brings out of Plato's Phaedrus. Now, I could have just brought the Phaedrus out and given it to you, but I want you to be able to go back in your own experience, look up in your files this chapter 2, The Art of Memory in Greece, Memory and the Soul. Go to page 38 and put this quotation not only in the context of the cassette of this lecture, but in the context of this chapter and the lectures that accompanied this chapter at the time about 3-4 months ago. Now if you will do that, if you just shoulder that burden of doing that, there should be a juxtaposition. Those lectures then, which I assure you were totally spontaneous, there's no pre-planned grist that I'm dishing out, but those lectures should fit like dovetailing with this lecture today. Those lectures concerned magic, concerned psychic energy. This lecture concerns art. And before you can have art, you have to have the artist. It's just as simple as that. There has to be an artist. Here's the quotation from Plato, from the Phaedrus. Socrates tells the story about the invention of alphabet writing, which happened historically about 1700 BC, about 3700 years ago. It was a knockout when it happened. I heard then that Naucratis in Egypt was one of the ancient gods of that country, the one whose sacred bird is called the ibis. And the name of the god himself was Thoth. He it was who invented numbers and arithmetic and geometry and astronomy. Remember now that numbers is a euphemism for music, and that music and arithmetic, geometry and astronomy are the square, the quadrivium, which is the basis of mental development in the Pythagorean tradition, which means that the Pythagorean mental training is in the Hermetic tradition from ancient Egypt. He also invented draughts and dice, and most important of all, letters. Now the king of all Egypt at that time was the god Thamus, just the pharaoh, Thamus, who lived in a great city in the upper region, which the Greeks called the Egyptian Thebes. And they called the god himself Amun, Amun-Ra. To him came Thoth to show his inventions, saying that they ought to be imparted to the other Egyptians. But Thamus asked what use there was in each, and as Thamus enumerated their uses, expressed praise or blame of the various arts, which it would take too long to repeat. But when they came to letters, "This invention, O king," said Thoth, "will make the Egyptians wiser and will improve their memories, for it is an elixir of memory and wisdom that I have discovered." Notice the alchemical term. What is an elixir? An elixir is something that you take into yourself. We usually think of it as a fluid which you take into yourself. An alphabetized written language is an elixir of memory and wisdom that I have discovered. But Thamus replied, "Most ingenious Thoth, one man has the ability to beget arts, but the ability to judge of their usefulness or harmfulness to their users belongs to another. And now you, who are the father of letters, have been led by your affection to your children to ascribe to them a power the opposite of that which they really possess. For this invention will produce forgetfulness, not memory, but forgetfulness, and not wisdom, but false knowledge." Notice something here. Notice that false knowledge is not the opposite of wisdom. Ignorance would be the normal, the natural opposite of wisdom. But in a sociological world, not in a natural world, in a sociological world, false wisdom is the opposite of wisdom. Ignorance becomes the obverse. Ignorance is the obverse of wisdom. And so there's a correlative diagonal that always happens by association, that false knowledge always considers itself not ignorance. And it's quite right. The ego is unable, the naive ego is unable to differentiate between ignorance and false knowledge, other than the fact that it knows that that relationship, that false knowledge, the knowledge they have, is certainly not ignorance, so it must be wisdom. It's a structural problem in the mind. Don't tell your other teachers. They won't believe you. "So what you invented," says the king to Thoth, "is not an elixir of memory and wisdom, but an elixir of forgetfulness and false wisdom. It will produce forgetfulness in the minds of those who learn to use it, because they will not practice their memory." Why? Because they will not practice their memory. Remember the differentiation between imagination and memory now. Remember that imagination always moves towards integration and memory always moves towards expression. It's like an hourglass. An image base is like the base of the hourglass, and the expression, imagination, always moves towards an integration, an interior self, an interior focus, carrying with it feeling, carrying with it the intelligence of feeling. And when all the feelings come together, no one feeling dominates, and a sense of tranquility in the deep self is there, not because there's no feeling, but because all feelings are evenly balanced together at a single focus. In a deep samadhi, that's exactly what occurs. To say that there is no feeling, that the void, shunyata, is no feeling, shows lack of experience. Actual experience shows that all feelings are balanced with equanimity. Hence, the classic euphemism, in the West is more expressively accurate than the characterizations given in the technical manuals of the East. In the West, the expression is an oceanic expansiveness. It's quite different from the yogic notion of ananda or bliss. It's different. How is it different? It's different because the oceanic feeling is had by someone's experience, whereas in bliss there is no subject whatsoever. It's different. In other words, if you stay there at the center, and you can discipline yourself for that, you're oblivious to the world. It's just that, just like if you're driving along and you catch yourself, the modern python, if you're driving along and you catch yourself daydreaming about something else, you're there where your thought is and not behind the wheel, and sometimes you catch yourself. You don't remember what was just now happening. You transposed your attention to the daydream and not to what was happening. But if you were to stop your car and pull over and have a Yogacaran experience and go back into that, you could bring back out of your memory exactly what happened physiologically. But what would not be there would be the daydream. And you could reconstruct exactly the experience of what happened. You could read the road signs. Every aspect would be there, but the daydream would not be there. Why? Because the daydream is an imaginative mode, and the mnemonic mode is much more powerful than the imaginative mode. Memory is much more powerful than imagination. If you learn well, you think by imagination. When you get to learning by memory, you'll be astounded. The symbolic self is much more powerful than the natural self. But it's not different from the natural self. It is, to use that phrase, organically continuous with it. So Thomas tells Thoth, you've done a bad thing, young man. Their trust in writing produced by external characters which are not part of themselves will discourage use of their own memory within them. You have invented an elixir not of memory, but of reminding. And you offer your pupils the appearance of wisdom, not true wisdom. And out of this, Plato wrote the Phaedrus about somewhere in the 370s BC. This is the first coherent statement of the problem of appearance and reality, as it's come down in Western thought, appearance and reality. If someone is just writing, those words on the page, that use of externalized, written, alphabet language are an appearance. But if a poet writes, if Basho writes a haiku, is that haiku an appearance? No, it's a reality. It's as real as any physical object is. Now, for a writer to come to that realization makes an artist out of the writer. No matter how good a craftsman he was before, he's changed, he's different. The classic example in our time, in our country here, was William Faulkner, who got desperate about not being published and not being read and tired of being poor and everything, and he wrote a potboiler. Sanctuary. He put everything he could imagine into it to juice it up. It was banned all over the place. but it didn't make enough money to get him out of the job that he had, which was shoveling coal in the basement of the University of Mississippi, keeping the furnaces stoked for the to keep the university warm. And so he was down there all alone in the cold Mississippi night, shoveling the coal, thinking over things, and suddenly he had a realization. He talked about it one time only. He was at the University of Virginia, and somebody had mentioned something about why aren't there a lot of great writers, and Faulkner was trying to tell the person that good writing has bones and flesh and soul. And the person wasn't understanding, and finally he told this story, and he said that he came to the realization that characters cast shadows. That a so-called fictional character, if written from one's deep self, is written about that character is as real as anybody who ever lived. And he said, when I realized that characters cast shadows, he said, I couldn't write potboilers anymore. He had an ethical, the word that comes to my mind, unfortunately, has a kind of a cultural, he had an ethical imprimatur to write only legitimately from then on. And the first thing that he wrote after that was As I Lay Dying. And if you take Sanctuary and As I Lay Dying, they're written within a year of each other, totally different works. One of them is a work of fiction. The other is a work of art. One of them is a very good craftsman putting all the tricks that he's learned in, and the other one is someone speaking from the heart, as we would say, one from the heart. In Sanctuary, what is kind of engrossing is the convolutedness of the narrative, all of the pyrotechnic tricks that Faulkner was capable of, and he was really very good at that. But in As I Lay Dying, there is no narrative whatsoever. The reader, in his experience of reading, is the only narrative context that there is in As I Lay Dying. It is like a pure drama of the deep self. And As I Lay Dying will match up with Euripides or Sophocles or Aeschylus any day. The novel, 2,000 years from now, can be read as an example of classic literature, of the way in which an artist has just now come to himself and realized that his works of art are real. They're not appearances. They are real. They're like, truly, children of himself. They have that kind of a relationship. And they have a life of their own once born. A real artist who has finished a work of art has a respect for that work's integrity and it and the life of its own. To try and bring it back, to revise it or tamper with it, would be a sacrilege. To burn it or destroy it would be a murder. There is that kind of a basis. Now in Faulkner, he doesn't talk about it very much. The writer in the 20th century who really goes into this was Don Miguel de Unamuno. But Unamuno understood that the mentor in this mode of recognition that writing is real was Cervantes. Because Cervantes is no more real nor no less real than his character Don Quixote, or Sancho Panza for that matter. Speak of Don Quixote as the symbolic example here. For us, Don Quixote is as real as any figure who ever lived. When did Don Quixote live? Did Don Quixote live in 1600? Did he live in 1500? Did he live in 1200? It's a peculiar thing, but Don Quixote actually lives every time someone reads Don Quixote. Vladimir Nabokov did a series of essays on Don Quixote a few years ago, and was just full of awe of Cervantes' artistry. Not just the incredible sense of deep, humane humor won through years of suffering and travail, but the fact that when you read Don Quixote lives. He exists then. He can be alive in 1989. A work of art from the deep self is eternally real. Just like you, when you really are yourself in your life from your deep self are eternal. It's not a hypothetical proposition. It's not a metaphysical doctrine. It is an experience capable of artistic expression and of historical realization. Now, this is really powerful, and I don't want to overdo it too much, but